Today, I think I might finish up the series on His Needs, Her Needs. I don't think I probably have enough for two sermons, so we'll see how it goes. We are down to the men's needs. We started on those last Sunday. We are on number two of the men's needs, and that is recreational companionship. And we may finish up all four of the remaining men's needs or not. We'll see. So if you have an outline, we are down at the bottom of page 14. So recreational companionship. The Bible does teach this, as it does teach the other 10 needs, the five needs of women, the primary needs, and the five primary needs of men. And Solomon exhorted us in the book of Ecclesiastes on several different occasions that we should enjoy the fruit of our labor, which is a roundabout way of telling us that we should enjoy some recreation. In Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 24, this is one of the places. Ecclesiastes 5 is another one we'll get to next. Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 24, Solomon said, "There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw, that it was from the hand of God." So this is something that I need to remind myself about, because I tend to probably err on the other side of saving and worrying about the future too much and not enjoying the present enough. But Solomon said right there, nothing better than to eat and to drink and enjoy the good of your labor. So there, we should always make sure, and if you can, unless you're just dirt poor, to set aside some money anyway to enjoy yourself with. And I was listening to a guy, and the who it was doesn't matter, but anyway, some guy, and he was an author. And he said that whenever you're an author, if you actually make money at it, which very few do, you get a lot of times a big foreword for your book, and which would be multiple thousands of dollars, and then you're writing for a long time, and you have to live on that money, and you have like a scarcity mindset almost, where you feel like you don't want to spend anything. And but what he would do is, when he would get that foreword, he would take, I don't know, I forget what he said, if it was 10% of it or something, he would set that aside for just his fun money. And then he could use that. He lived in New York City, so to take a cab instead of the bus, or to go out to eat, or something like that. And I thought that's a good idea. And so I encourage. I wouldn't say 10%. I think that's a bit much to go play around with. But anyway, take a percentage and put that in an account and just enjoy yourself with it. But anyway, that's really not the subject of the sermon today. But if you turn again to Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 18, 5:18, he says, "Behold, that which I have seen. It is good and comely for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him, for it is his portion." So it's a good thing to enjoy yourself, to enjoy the fruit of your labor. And so this means, naturally, that God wants us to enjoy some recreational enjoyment. There's nothing wrong with that. It says in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 17 that God hath given us richly all things to enjoy. And men, husbands, should be having this enjoyment with their wives. Solomon told us in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9, and this is where we're going with this, that this is a primary need of a lot of men anyway, to have recreational companionship with their wives. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9, Solomon says, "Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity." This life is vain, but at least having a good wife can make it a lot less vain. It can make it a better existence for us. "Which he hath given thee under the sun all the days of the life, or all the days of thy vanity, for that is thy portion in this life and in thy labor which thou takest under the sun." So enjoy yourself with your wife. Enjoy some recreational companionship is what he's telling us. And I was thinking about this just, I think it was yesterday, that I remembered the verse in Malachi, which says that a man's wife is his companion. Malachi 2 and verse 14. Malachi 2 and verse 14. Just to show you that when you put these together, so you're supposed to live joyfully with the wife of thy youth, and then she's your companion. So what is she then? She's your recreational companion, right? Kind of all fits together. Malachi 2 and verse 14. "Yet ye say, Wherefore? Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously, yet is she thy companion and the wife of thy covenant." So the Lord was chastening the husbands here in Israel for treating their wives badly, and reminding them that she is your companion. She should be your friend. And Solomon taught us this, which we'll look at later on here, that our wives should be our best friends. So one way for a man to live joyfully with his wife is by sharing his recreational activities with her. And I think some people drop the ball in this one. I think a lot of times men especially think that they just go off and do their recreational stuff without their wives and go out and hang out with the boys or whatever, and their wife can do whatever she wants to do. And I'm not saying that's wrong every time, but I think if you have too much of that, I don't think that's a good thing. And Harley agrees with me, for whatever that's worth. So I don't so there's at least two of us out there anyway. And when two or three of you are agreed on anything, Jesus said it shall be done. So there you go. So anyway, of course, I'm kidding. But anyway, men like it when women take interest in their hobbies and their interests. I think most men would agree with that. If your wife takes an interest in what you have an interest in, that men like that, right? You come out to the garage and check out what you're looking at or what you're working on or something. Men like that. Right, that makes you feel good. Or if you come home with a big buck and she looks at it and says, "Wow, that thing's awesome! Man, how did you shoot it? How did that? You know, what was it like?" You know, men like that kind of thing. They really do. I just give you a couple examples of couples in the Scripture that were companions. One of them is a couple named Aquila and Priscilla. If you turn to Acts 18, we'll read a little bit about Aquila and Priscilla here. They were what I would call a husband and wife team. They had common interest. They even had a common occupation. They worked together, and they also did the work of the Lord together. So they were quite the couple. And you read about them several times in the Bible. Paul mentions them numerous times in numerous epistles. So this was an influential couple. Acts 18 and verses 2 through 3. Says, and found, this is Paul whenever he gets to Corinth, and found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, lately come from Italy, with his wife Priscilla, because that Claudius had commanded all Jews to depart from Rome, and came unto them, and because he was of the same craft, he abode with them and wrought, which means he worked, for by their occupation they were tent makers. So all of the three of them, Paul, Aquila, and Priscilla, were all tent makers. And he did some work with them, because Paul says in another place that he had worked with his own hands and provided for his own needs and didn't even take support from one of the churches, just to prove a point, just to show them how to work hard and to not be slothful. And then Aquila and Priscilla also did the work of the Lord together in verse 18 here. Anyway, he tarried with them. I'm not sure what the point of verse 18 was. But anyway, turn to verse 26. Sometimes I don't remember. I have an excuse. It was 3 years ago. I don't know why I put verse 18 in there. Who knows? Verse 26. And he began to speak boldly. This is Apollos. He was a preacher. Good preacher, but needed to learn some more things. There were some things that he didn't understand yet. And he began to speak boldly in the synagogue, whom when Aquila and Priscilla had heard, they took him unto them and expounded unto him the way of God more perfectly. So they were well versed enough in the Scripture, the two of them, that they actually took this preacher aside. They didn't stand up and yell heresy or something. They took him aside afterwards and explained and expounded to him the way of God more perfectly. He didn't. The only thing he knew was the baptism of John, and he needed to learn some more things. So anyway, they were a husband and wife team. Engaged in spiritual things, engaged in material things. They were quite the couple. And then you have an Old Testament example, which I thought about here just the other day, and that was Isaac and Rebekah. If you look in Genesis 26 and verse 8, this verse came to mind, and then I looked up the definition, which I have never done. I always assumed I knew what it meant, and wasn't really what I was thinking, but Genesis 26 and verse 8. This one will show you that husbands and wives ought to be partaking of recreation together, because this is exactly what Isaac and Rebekah were doing. Genesis 26 and verse 8. This is whenever Isaac went to Gerar and he lied, like his dad did, like Abraham did, and said that Rebekah was his sister because he was afraid that they would kill him for her. He should have learned the lesson from Abraham, but he didn't. Anyway, in verse 8, it says, "And it came to pass, when he had been there a long time, that is Isaac, and Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, looked out a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was sporting with his wife." I always thought that must have meant like making out or something like that. But I don't think that's what they were doing, right? That would have been fine. They were married, no big deal. But I don't think that's what they were doing because, I mean, I guess you could call that a sport. You know, if that's the case, I am into sports. I kind of like it. But anyway, sporting means engaged in sport or play. And I get maybe the play thing, I don't know. But then sport means pleasant pastime, entertainment or amusement, recreation or diversion. So it could have been they were just out there kind of just, you know, like what husbands and wives do, just playing around, goofing around, you know, chasing each other around or something. I don't know how old they were, but they could have been, you know, just goofing around and picking and teasing at each other. I don't know what they were doing. But anyway, Abimelech saw it and he's like, wait a minute. I mean, this isn't how you act like with your sister. This is just weird. Either you two are inbred or else you've been lying to me, one of the two. There's something going on here. But anyway, so he was reproved for that. So recreational companionship is very important to most men. And like I said, I think I've said this earlier, that all of these needs, probably everybody, or at least men and women, are going to have their respective needs to some degree, but some people are probably going to have more of one than the other, and they might not be in the order that Harley has put them in his book, or that I put them in the same order that he did. So anyway, if this isn't your thing, and I'll explain to you why it's not really my thing, and I'll explain to you why I think that maybe I'm just a little bit odd because I don't really fit into what Harley says based on his experience. So let me read you a quote here from his book. This is on page 77 of His Needs, Her Needs. He says, "It is not uncommon for women, when they are single, to join men in pursuing their interests. They find themselves hunting, fishing, playing football, and watching movies that they would never have chosen on their own. After marriage, wives often try to interest their husbands in activities more to their own liking. If their attempts fail, they may encourage their husbands to continue in recreational activities without them. I consider that option very dangerous to a marriage because men place surprising importance on having their wives as recreational companions. The TV stereotypes paint the opposite picture, showing the husbands with the boys on fishing trips, saying, it doesn't get any better than this. My counseling files say it can get a lot better. In fact, among the five basic male needs, spending recreational time with his wife is second only to sex for the typical husband." And I was kind of surprised by that because that's not my experience. But then again, I'm not, you know, I'm not the average guy. I don't know. I kind of am different and think differently and act differently than some people. So anyway, nothing wrong with that. But anyway, I think the reason for that is that this need is not high. That is, recreational companionship is not high on my priority list, I guess. And I think why that is just because I'm more driven for production than I am for recreation. So recreation is just not really a big thing on my list. Of course, I like to have a little bit like anybody, but not a huge thing for me. And I think because production is high on my list, therefore domestic support is highest on my list for my needs, because if my wife provides my domestic support, then I can do my work, right? If she's taking care of all the stuff in the house, then I can focus on my work. So I think it kind of makes sense to me why my needs are ordered in the way that they are. Of course, spending time with my wife is high on my list, but just the recreational stuff is not necessarily. And one of the reasons for that is just at this point in my life, I don't have time or money for it, right? I'd love to do any number of things. I love water skiing. I love snow skiing. I love hunting. I love, you know, all kinds of stuff. But I just don't. I don't have the time and the money for all that fun stuff that would be cool to do, if I could. So anyway, that's just me though. So here's what Harley recommends, and I think this is good. You want to find recreational activities that both the husband and the wife can enjoy together, because you can imagine if the husband wants his wife to do his recreational activities with him, but she just absolutely hates whatever his favorite thing to do is, that's going to be really difficult for her to do that, right? She's going to have to just kind of grin and bear it, and that's no fun for anybody. But what Harley goes on to say is, if you can find things that you both like to do and then focus on those things, though maybe it's not your absolute favorite thing to do, you can both enjoy doing them. And I'll give you one of his quotes to show you that here in a second. He says there on page 83, engage in only those recreational activities that both you and your spouse can enjoy together. And in order to find these activities that you can both enjoy, then husband and wife can go through a list, and you can find, just go online, type in a list of fun things to do, or a list of recreational activities, or list of hobbies, or whatever, and you'll probably find hundreds of them, and go through that list, each of you separately, and pick out the things that you like, you both like to do, and then look and see where those lists overlap, and see what things that you both like to do. And once you find those activities, then you can focus on doing those ones together, and you may not equally enjoy both of them, but if you both at least enjoy them, then it's something that you can do together, and one of you is not going to be totally bored, and you know the other one's not going to be disappointed because his spouse is not really into it. So, I mean, just an example, maybe you just love hunting, and she just can't stand hunting, but you also like fishing, and she's okay with fishing. She can do that as long as you bait the hook for her and, you know, take the fish off and whatever, that kind of thing. Then, you know, then I'm not saying never hunt again, but maybe spend a little more time fishing when you can do it together with your spouse than spending all of your time hunting. Just, you know, just an example. And there could be hundreds of other things just like that. Of course, you're not going to be able to do everything that you would like, but nobody has time to do everything they want to do anyway, right? I mean, there's a million things that I think would be fun to do, but I'm not going to get to do most of them in my lifetime, and I'm not worried about that, because we get all eternity in heaven to do whatever God has laid up for us there, and it's going to be more enjoyable than anything down here, whatever that is. And I would just say, I was thinking about this, if you live the same way after you're married that you did before you're married, you're going to have a rough marriage, right? If you spend the same amount of time doing the same things that you did before you were married after, you're going to have big problems, right? If you love to spend every night of the week hunting all winter long or whatever, you're going to have problems in your marriage, right? Or if you like to spend all of your time out on the lake, or all of your time in the garage, or all of your time at the races, or all of your time doing whatever, any number of things, you're going to have problems. Marriage is about sacrifice, right? It's about giving up things and not being able to enjoy all the things that you once did and you wanted to. But it's a sacrifice that's worth making, in my opinion, of course, and I think you would all agree with me. Here's what Harley said. He said, you can't do everything. Out of thousands of possible activities, there will probably exist only a few hundred that my wife and I would enjoy thoroughly. I cannot possibly do all those hundreds of things that my wife and I would enjoy. Why then should I waste my time doing the things my wife finds no pleasure in? This policy of engaging in only mutually appealing activities is not a summons to a lifetime of misery or deprivation. It simply means choosing activities I already enjoy by taking my wife's feelings into account. Why should I wish to gain at her expense when we can gain together? And I think that just makes good sense, right? I'm not sure who could argue with that unless they're just being selfish and stupid. A man's wife should be the most important thing to him after God and his church, and therefore giving up certain recreational activities in order to maintain a close relationship with his wife is well worth it. Not to mention, when you're married, especially when you have kids, you just don't have time for a lot of recreational stuff, right? I mean, you've got a lot of things to do at home to raise your children. And then I also wanted to mention that husbands and wives should be friends. The Bible's taught that for thousands of years, and I really believe that. I think your wife should be your best friend. And we have an example of that in Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon 5:16. Song of Solomon 5:16. Song of Solomon's right after Ecclesiastes, which is after Proverbs, which is after Psalms, in case you're having trouble finding it. Song of Solomon 5:16. Says, his mouth is most sweet, yea, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. So Solomon's wife, I don't know which of the thousand this one was, but apparently it was one of his special favorites or something. Kind of odd to have a thousand wives and write a love story in the Bible about one of them, but maybe this was his first one. I don't know who it was. It doesn't say. But anyway, they were friends. And husband and wife relationship is what you call friends with benefits, right? The kids love that term, but that's an evil term for kids, but it's true for husband and wives. Anyway. And then just consider how Solomon loved his friend, his best friend. Song of Solomon 4, 9 through 10. 4, 9 through 10. He says, "Thou hast ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse." Sister in faith, right? I'm sure this was not his natural sister. That was not allowed. That at one time, way back in the garden, in the beginning, that was allowable, but not at this time. So I'm assuming he's calling her his sister in faith and that kind of thing. "Thou hast ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. Thou hast ravished my heart with one of thine eyes, with one chain of thy neck. Oh, how fair is thy love, my sister, my spouse. How much better is thy love than wine, and the smell of thine ointments than all spices. Thy lips, my spouse, drop as an honeycomb. Honey and milk are under thy tongue, and the smell of thy garments is like the smell of Lebanon." So this guy was in love with his friend, right? They were friends and lovers, and that's what a good marriage should be. So Harley maintains that husband and wife should engage in most recreational activities, or should not engage in most recreational activities unless they can both share them together, and I definitely agree with that. And I would say if you start doing that, then you could become best friends with your wife, even if you're not now. Because if you spend a lot of time together, especially enjoyable time, doing things you both like to do, then you really start to build a close relationship. And here's the other thing. You remember one of the woman's primary needs was affection and conversation, especially the conversational aspect. If you do things together that you both like, then you have something to talk about that you both like too. And then you kill two birds with one stone. You get your recreational companionship need met, and she gets her conversational need met, and it's a win-win situation. All right, so that was the second need of husbands. Let's go to the third, and that is an attractive wife. Men are attracted to women largely by sight. Women are not like this, typically. Remember what Job said. We don't need to turn there, but Job 31:1, pardon me. It seems like I always get the hiccups when I'm preaching. I hate that. Anyway, he said that, "I have made a covenant with mine eyes. Why then should I look upon a maid?" The idea is, for men especially, marriage is a covenant of the eyes. You promise not to look upon another woman as the object of your love and affection. And that's very important for men because, as my wife told me one time, I haven't heard her say this in a long time, but it was true years ago when she said it. She said, "Men like what they see, but women like what they hear." And I'll tell you what, that's true. That is some sound wisdom right there. Men like what they see, women like what they hear. So I would say, based on that, it's important for women to stay looking nice, and it's important for men to stay being nice. Remember that. I just thought about that one this morning. I think that's pretty important. Let me repeat that. It's important for women to stay looking nice. It's important for men to stay being nice. Because women are much more important. They would much rather have a nice man than a big, handsome man, right? I think most women would, anyway. Which is good for, you know, us men that aren't that great looking, because we still have a decent chance, if we actually can be nice, you know, of getting a good woman. Men have a strong desire to behold the beauty of a woman, and that's just, you know, some people might say, "Oh, that's just so shallow and carnal. Men are just pigs." No, that's just the way they are. That's just the way that we're made. Men like looking at a beautiful woman. Proverbs 5 and verse 19. Proverbs 5:19. I'll just give you a few verses for this to show you that the Bible perfectly portrays human nature. Proverbs 5:19. "Let her be as the loving hind." Somebody just told me the other day that I've been pronouncing that wrong for my entire life, and she was right. "Let her be as the loving hind," not hind, "hind, and pleasant roe. Let her breasts satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love." So men love to look at a beautiful woman, like I said. Israel was told back in Deuteronomy, we don't need to turn there, but Deuteronomy 21:11, he said that, the Lord said that if they had been warring with another country and they had taken captives of war, and some of those captives were women, and he said, if you see among the captives a beautiful woman and hast a desire to her, they were to take her home. And this is weird, but this is what the Lord said, so I guess it's not weird, but it sounds strange by today's standards, we'll put it that way, but the Lord obviously had a reason for it. He said, take her home, shave her head and pare her nails, and make her put on the clothing, the raiment of her captivity, and mourn for a month, I think it was. And then after that, you'd go into her and she'd be your wife. And then if you didn't like her, then you sent her on. But like I said, different, not the way we do things today under New Testament standards. But anyway, but the point was, if they saw a beautiful woman among the captives, right? Men notice that beautiful woman right away. And I guess the Lord wanted to make sure that they wanted her for the right reason, because you shave her head, pare her nails, and then you still like her? Okay, you still like her. You must really like her. You must not just be infatuated, I guess is what was going on there. I don't know. And this sight of the eyes that men are driven by, this tends to get men in trouble. And this is why they have to guard their eyes. Proverbs 6 and verse 25 says, "Lust not after her beauty in thine heart, neither let her take thee with her eyelids." Men have to be really careful about this before they're married and especially after they're married. Remember what happened to David, 2 Samuel 11 and verse 2. He was on his roof and he saw a beautiful woman, a woman bathing that was beautiful to look upon. That was Bathsheba. And he committed adultery with her and was judged severely for that. And remember what Jesus said in Matthew 5 and verse 28. I will go ahead and turn to that one. That God considers it the same whether you look upon and lust after a woman or whether you actually committed the act. God still considers it adultery, regardless whether you did it or not. If you think about it in your heart, in your mind, you have done the sin in God's sight. Matthew 5:28. Jesus said, "But I say unto you that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart." So there are many sins, probably most of them, that we can commit in the heart, right? You could think about killing somebody, and Jesus says that you're a murderer. You could hate somebody in your heart and want to kill them, and Jesus says you're guilty of murder. Or you could think about, if I could just steal that car, I would. If I could do it and get away with it, I would. You may as well go do it, because you know what? God, you're just as guilty before God, whether you did it or not. And this is why that a wife and a husband, it works both ways, is a covering of the eyes for the other one. This was actually said to Abraham in Genesis 20 and verse 16, but we can, I think, quite easily apply that the other way around to a woman being this to a man. Sarah was called a covering of Abraham's, or I'm sorry, Abraham was called a covering of Sarah's eyes. How much more so then is the wife the covering of the husband's eyes? Genesis 20 and verse 16. And unto Sarah he said, "This is Abimelech." This is, I don't know if this is the same king or if sometimes kings went by the same name, like Pharaoh. You know, there were many pharaohs in Egypt. There were at least three Herods in Israel. So I don't know if this is the same Abimelech that that Isaac deceived after Abraham deceived him or not. He's going to be steering clear of Hebrews if that's the case, because these guys keep lying to him. But anyway, he says there, when Abimelech speaking to Abraham, Genesis 20:16, "And unto Sarah he said, Behold, I have given thy brother 1,000 pieces of silver, because he is to thee a covering of the eyes unto all that are with thee and with all others. Thus she was reproved." So he's a covering to her eyes. She's not supposed to be looking on other men. How much more so then is a man's wife a covering of his eyes? It's as if your wife is blinders put on you. So you're not supposed to look. If she's standing right in front of you, you can't see any other women. That's the idea, covering of the eyes. So this is why it's important for a wife to stay attractive to her husband after they get married, because this is one of a man's primary needs. And yeah, maybe you think for women, they don't get it and it just seems carnal and it seems materialistic or whatever, but it's a real need for men. And this is especially important as women age. Harley says here on page 107 and 108, "By calling for a wife to be attractive, I mean she should take pains to look something like the woman her husband married. After all, that was the woman he fell in love with, not a movie star or some fantasy." So he's not saying, I'm not saying, nobody's saying that a woman should try to look like a supermodel for her husband. Right? Just try to look like the woman that he married, or something close to it. As you age, of course, nobody's going to look as pretty. None of us are going to look as nice as we did when we were young. But try to look, you know, something like you did whenever you were married. Does this mean a woman must stay eternally young? Of course not. But getting old provides no excuse for letting weight creep up and up, not fixing your hair, and dressing like a bag lady. And I agree. I mean, that's his words, not mine, but I concur. I think he's right. So I'm going to go over four things here that wives can do to stay attractive for their husbands. And I actually only agree with myself on three of them now. I preached this thing, or I wrote this outline 3.5 years ago, or over 3 years ago anyway. And like I said, I have left the outline intact. I haven't changed anything. But then I'm going to tell you why I don't agree with myself anymore. So you could call me a double-minded man if you want. That's okay. So the first one is weight control. Women often keep themselves in good shape until after they get married, and then they let themselves go and gain a lot of weight. And I'm sure we've all seen this before, right? I've seen women that have probably doubled in size, not long after they got married, and that's just not right. You know, gaining a few pounds here and there is one thing, but just letting yourself go and just not caring, throwing caution to the wind, that's not right. I know I've talked about this before, so I'm not going to belabor the point. Not fair to the husband because he fell in love with, assuming it was a thin, attractive woman. Let me make it understandable to the women. So maybe the women are like, oh, who cares, right? He should love me for me. So it shouldn't matter if I put on weight, right? Well, think about this. So one of your primary needs is affection, right? So let's just say when you were dating your husband, he was really nice, very kind, very sweet, very gentlemanlike, and you fell in love with him because that's what he was like. And then imagine after you get married, he just turns into an insensitive jerk. And you think, well, that's not right. Now, could the husband say, oh, she should love me for who I am, and it doesn't matter if I'm an insensitive jerk, right? I shouldn't have to act like I used to. No woman would buy that, and that's not right. But it's the same way with men with the looks of their wives. So keeping weight off as we age is not easy. Everybody knows that, especially when you get to that age where your metabolism changes, which happens to a lot of people. It's not easy. It's difficult work. But it should be made a priority for our spouses. I think men should make this a priority too. I don't think men should let themselves go and be a big fat pig either, just because they don't think their wives would care. I don't think that's nice for them, especially for the sake of husbands who have this basic need for an attractive wife. I think it's good for husbands and wives to diet and exercise together, which makes cooking easier for the wife and will motivate both partners to stay in shape. So if one of you has a hard time keeping weight off, then exercise together, diet together, and, you know, eat the same thing, same portion, same amount as each other are, and then you can be in it together and you can suffer together if you have to. But I think if you just eat the right type of things, it has a lot to do with what you eat, not so much how much you eat. How much you eat certainly plays a part in it, but what you eat has a lot more to do with it than anything else. And I'm no dietitian up here, but if you stay away from carbs and sugars, chances are you're going to lose weight. So anyway, just go to the grocery store, buy meat and vegetables, and there's your diet plan right there. Pretty simple. Okay, so here's the one that I don't agree with myself on anymore, and that is makeup. I have changed my mind. I haven't changed the outline, but I've changed my mind on this one, on some parts of it. So I'm just going to read the outline as it is, and I'll show you where I've changed my mind. Makeup can enhance a woman's looks if it's done right. I still agree with that. I still do agree with that. But a woman's primary source of beauty should come from within. Of course, I still agree with that. Turn to 1 Peter 3, 3 through 5. 1 Peter 3, 3 through 5. The Bible doesn't forbid wearing makeup. It doesn't forbid braiding your hair and wearing jewelry and things like that. But it says that when you do those things, that should not be the focus of your who you are, right? Your focus should be on the inward man. That's where the real beauty is. 1 Peter 3, 3 through 5. Who's speaking of the godly women, whose adorning, let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting, that is like braiding, plaiting the hair, or of wearing of gold, or putting on of apparel. Now, somebody might read that and say, see, you cannot ever braid your hair. Okay, then you can never put on apparel either. Okay? So if you think it's okay to, you know, never braid your hair, then walk around nude, I guess, and be consistent. It's saying that this should not be your main focus of your adornment, right? But let it be the hidden man of the heart. So you can't adorn yourself physically with the hidden man of the heart. He's showing you what, you know, it should be a spiritual matter. That's where you really should be focused. In that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. For after this manner, in the old time, the holy women also, who trusted in God, adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands. Nothing worse than a fair woman without discretion. Take a fair woman, beautifully adorned, that doesn't submit to her husband. And she's not a fair woman, not in my book. She's an odious woman in my book. And in God's book, because that's what he says about her. Like a jewel of gold in a swine's snout. Now, some men don't like makeup, and a wife should consider that before wearing it. I still agree with that. And here's what happened. When I wrote the outline, I wasn't really one of those men. But now I am one of those men. Now, I realize this one, I don't know why I'm dumb enough to repeat this, because this has got me into trouble before. It was amazing. I'll tell you that story in just a second. But I am one of them. Now, I'm not saying that women can't or shouldn't wear makeup. I'm saying I don't want my wife to wear it, because I personally don't like it on my wife. Okay? That's my personal opinion. I'm not saying anybody else can't do it. I'm not saying it doesn't look nice. I think a lot of women look nice with makeup. But it's just not for me. I don't like the smell of it, the taste of it, the time it takes and the money it takes. But I don't, some makeup, some probably smells fine, but some of that stuff, to me, just it's overpowering. I hate it. I don't like it. And to kiss her when she's got makeup on or lipstick or something like that, that's not for me. Now, I'm not saying nobody else can do that. I'm saying that's my opinion. Now, you can be mad at me if you want. I've had other people that have been. I think that my wife looks just as beautiful when she wakes up in the morning right out of bed as she does right now. She looks about the same, right? She doesn't wear makeup, so there you go. She combs her hair before she gets here, but anyway. Now, believe it or not, I was attacked by 3 Christian women in Minneapolis for expressing this opinion, or expressing a variation of this opinion. 3 Christian women, 2 in the church and then 1 from a visiting church, and it was like a pack of hyenas that just attacked me like I was this poor gazelle, and I had to fight them off on my own. I'm not kidding you. Because somebody said something about their daughter wearing makeup, or they were talking about teenagers wearing makeup, and I just simply said, I just wouldn't let my teenage daughter wear makeup. And I'm telling you, they pounced like lions. It was unbelievable. My wife witnessed it. She saw it. I was just shocked. Literally had to fight them off on my own. I had no man there to help me. My own arm had to bring salvation, as the Lord says. But anyway. But, that's my opinion. And I'll tell you why. And you might not agree with this, and that's fine. But what is the point of women wearing makeup? It's to look attractive to a man, right? Right? Hopefully, if you're a married woman, to your husband. You shouldn't want to look attractive for other men. I'm going to talk about that. To look attractive for your husband. Now, if you're a teenager, why do you need to wear makeup? I wouldn't want my teenage daughter wearing makeup, because I wouldn't want her being attractive to some man yet if she's not old enough to get married, right? I hate to tell you, but men are pigs, right? There's a lot of nasty men out there. And, until my daughter was of age where she wanted to get married, I wouldn't want her to wear makeup and be attractive to a man. That's my opinion. Now, you, of course, hopefully you don't jump on me like a pack of hyenas like I did got up there. But anyway. Now, on the other hand, and this is the part that I don't agree with myself on anymore. But on the other hand, if a wife really desires to wear makeup because it makes her feel better about herself, a husband should respect that and not force her to not wear any, and especially shouldn't make remarks in the presence of others about how his wife is pretty and doesn't need makeup. I actually put that in there because somebody gave me that piece of advice, and I've since come to realize that I just don't agree with that piece of advice. I think women should wear makeup for their husbands if their husbands like it. But if the husband doesn't like makeup, then why would a woman wear makeup if her husband doesn't like it? Because she should be wearing it for him, to look nice for him, right? So I don't agree with what I wrote there anymore. But, this is my opinion. You can have your own opinion on that. Harley says there on page 112, with married women, their husbands appreciate and encourage the change in their wives if their wives have done it for them. Be certain that in addition to being something you like, your husband also finds the cosmetic changes attractive. Keep in mind that your objective is meeting his need for your physical attractiveness. And I totally agree. Wives should be meeting their husband's need for physical attractiveness. Now we're going to talk, and I'm going to, and he will clarify himself that I would not say that, you know, a husband would be wrong to make his wife dress or wear her hair or wear makeup or a certain way where she just hated it. She just felt horrible. She felt embarrassed. She just didn't like it. Right? That wouldn't be right. Of course, there's got to be some place where you can both be happy with it. Right? So I'm not saying that the wife should just make herself miserable for her husband's sake, but I am also saying that a wife shouldn't just be purely selfish either and just be like, this is the way I like to look, and I don't care what he thinks. I don't think that's a wise idea. Okay, so the third way that a woman can stay looking attractive for her husband is hairstyle. In addition to gaining weight after getting married, many women also like to cut their hair off short because it's easier to take care of. I've seen this lots of times. Women have nice long hair, then they get married and they crop it off real short just because, you know, they don't want to deal with it anymore. And I don't think that's right either for two reasons. For the first reason is that the Bible says that women ought to have long hair. So that's the first one. 1 Corinthians 11, 5 through 6. 1 Corinthians 11, 5 through 6. And this especially, I don't know why this is, but this especially happens when women get older. And I don't know if it just gets more to take care of and they just, you know, cut it off real short or what. But I don't understand that, but I'm not a woman. 1 Corinthians 11, 5 through 6, it says, "But every woman that prayeth or prophesieth with her head uncovered dishonoreth her head, for that is even all one as if she were shaven. For if a woman be not covered, let her also be shorn, but if it be a shame for a woman to be shorn or shaven, let her be covered." So Paul's saying whatever this covering is, that the woman ought to have this covering on, and if she doesn't have it on, you may as well shave your head. That's what Paul's saying. What is the covering? The covering there is in verse 15. He says, "But if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given her for a covering." So there's the covering. A woman ought to have long hair. Now, of course, long is a subjective term, but as I've taught before, I would say based on logic, that means that a woman's hair should be at least chin length, right? If it's chin length, then it's covering her head, right? If it's, you know, I've heard some people say just covering the ears. Well, I mean, if you just had hair that just covered your ears, I don't really consider that covering, long hair that covers the head. But if it's chin length, right, then we're talking, you know, you're covering. Secondly, the second reason why there's problems with women cutting their hair short after they get married is that a wife should have a hairstyle that pleases her husband and makes her look attractive to him, right? That she should be considering him in this, not just the ease of taking care of it. Now, I have a third reason myself, and it's only because I'm a pastor, partly because I'm a pastor, but I don't want my wife to cut her hair short or even anywhere close to short because I have to be an example to the church, right? And my wife, to an extent, has to be an example too, because she has to be an example of what a Christian wife should be, because I'm supposed to be an example of, you know, what a Christian should be, which is a weighty task. So if her hair was cropped off right where I think is the minimum, right, chin length, then chances are somebody's going to say, well, if the pastor's wife's hair is chin length, mine can, you know, I can have a bowl cut, right, or whatever. That's just how people think. Right? Oh, if the pastor drank two beers, I can have three. Right? That's why I only have one. Not to mention, I can't drink more than one anyway. I'd be intoxicated. But even if I could, I would only drink one because wherever I am, some people are going to be further away. Some people are still going to play it safe, but some people are going to be like, oh, well, if the pastor did it, I can do twice as much. That's just how people think. So that's why I have my wife keep her hair longer and because I like it too. So that's two reasons. Give you a quote here from Harley. This is page 112 and 113. "Hairstyle and color are another sensitive issue or sensitive area for women. Yearly, they spend billions on dyes, rinses, shampoos, permanents, sets, and cuts. My question is why and for whom?" He's not saying that they shouldn't do this, but he's asking why, and like he said, for whom, why and Who are you doing this for? Whom are you doing this for? If a wife spends all that time and money to please her husband and to achieve something she finds comfortable, well and good. But if she lets some hairdresser talk her into something she knows her husband won't like, she has begun to work against herself and her marriage. A certain hair color manufacturer excuses the higher prices of his products by telling the woman, "You're worth it." More to the point, your husband is worth it. If he doesn't like a certain hairstyle or color, abandon it. In fact, consult with him ahead of time and get his opinion before ever getting a different style or coloring. After all, the whole idea is to be attractive to him. I totally agree. I don't think, and maybe this, you just think I'm a chauvinist or something, and you think, oh, a woman should just be able to do whatever she wants. I don't think a woman should go to the hairdresser and just get whatever haircut she feels like without ever asking her husband about it. I don't think that. Nor do I think that a man should do any number of things without asking his wife what she thinks about it too, and just do something that, you know, the man says, I'm the man, I'm going to paint the house, whatever, some awful color, just because I like it. Well, that's not nice, right? You should ask your wife, what color would you like the house to be? Take that into consideration. You could paint it like a rustic looking color, like Austin did his garage, right? That's in style these days, right? Make it look old and dilapidated, right? It looks cool. But, yeah, there you go. And he continues, or is it? So he said, after all, the whole idea is to be attractive to him. And then he says, or is it? Some women object to this idea. You know what they're called? Feminists. That's what they're called. They insist on the right to please themselves, and they argue that having to please their husbands in such a way seems unfair or even degrading. Then why did you get married? If you don't want to please your husband, why even get married? Right? Why just stay single? I don't encourage women, this is Harley speaking, I don't encourage women to meekly accept a hairstyle that makes them miserable. I don't either. I totally agree with them. Certainly they need to enjoy their own looks and feel a sense of attractiveness. Totally agree. If a woman likes something his wife can't tolerate, negotiation is in order. I agree. Among the many hairstyles available, I'm certain they can find one on which they can agree. And I think that's just good sense, right? So maybe she likes some hairstyle and you're like, I just hate that. I don't like that at all. And just look through a book and there's all these hairstyles and just pick out the ones you both like and then say, okay, get one of these. Right? That's not hard, I don't think. Here's another area. The fourth area where what women can do to stay attractive for their husbands is clothing. As with gaining weight and cropping the hair off, some women also dress unattractively for their husbands after they get married. And this isn't right either. I don't know why you'd want to do that, but some women do. They just let it go, right? They just don't care anymore. This can be especially hurtful to a husband if his wife dresses attractively when she goes out in public to be seen by other men, but not when she's around him. Just try to put yourselves in your husband's shoes, ladies. If your wife is only around you at home, she just looks like a slob and, you know, and wearing, you know, old threadbare clothing or whatever and just, you know, doesn't look nice. But then as soon as she goes outside of the house to be seen by somebody else, she's all nice looking. Think about that, right? Think about that. Women should dress modestly when they're in public. 1 Timothy 2:9, Paul says that I will that women adorn themselves in modest apparel. Right? So let me just refresh your memories. That means no short shorts above the knee, no short skirts or dresses above the knee, no low-cut shirts that show any cleavage at all, no one- or two-piece bathing suits unless you put a swimming trunks on the bottom or something because you're basically running around in your underwear. Right? It doesn't matter. Just because you're at the beach or the swimming pool doesn't mean you can run around in your underwear. Right? I've been over this stuff all before. Women should dress here's the flip side. Women should dress modestly in public. Women should dress as immodestly as their husbands would like whenever they're in private with them, right? But the funny thing is, this is usually the opposite. They get all dressed up and look like a hooker when they go outside, right? In front, so other men will see them. But when they're home, they're wearing some, you know, sweatpants and a hoodie or something. So not that there's anything wrong with sweatpants and a hoodie, but. Anyway, you get my point, right? They get all dolled up and look attractive for other men, but not for their husband, which is kind of weird. And I'll sum up this section with what Harley said here on page 113 and 14. He says, a woman should pay as much, if not more, attention to her choice of nightgown or pajamas as she does to what she wears in public. When she dresses for bed, she dresses strictly for her husband. Wearing old or bedraggled night clothes, curlers, and goop on her face, you know, everybody knows what he's talking about, right? And goop on her face will not put points in the love bank. Wearing a worn-out nightgown to bed because, quote, nobody will see it misses an important point. One very special and important person does see it, so why not wear something attractive and sexy? Your husband will certainly appreciate it. So, I think there's some wisdom in that. I personally don't really care, you know, what kind of nightgown or pajamas or whatever my wife wears. But, you know, if your husband likes that, if he wants you to wear lingerie to bed, then wear lingerie to bed, right? Why not? Okay, let me see here. I want to finish this up if possible. How much time? I think I have time to finish it up. I'm not gonna have enough for next sermon's gonna be like 20 minutes long or something like that if I stop. So I'm just gonna finish it up today. I think we can get through it. I don't think it's gonna take very long. Okay, the fourth need for a man is domestic support. So this is the counterpart of the wife's need for financial support. So husband provides financially, the wife provides domestic support, and these are complementary needs. I've been over this many times. Women are supposed to be keepers at home. I'll just read the verse again for the sake of fullness here, or for the sake of whatever the word I'm looking for is. Titus 2, 3 through 5. The aged women likewise, that they be in behavior as becometh holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. A keeper is one who has charge, care, or oversight of any person or thing, a guardian, a warden, a custodian. And that's sometimes what stay-at-home mothers feel like. Is a warden, right? Especially if you got a bunch of kids running around, you feel like you're maintaining some kind of an insane asylum or something to try to keep them all under control. And then women are also supposed to, wives are supposed to guide the house. We're told in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 14. Paul says, I will therefore that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. Guide the house instead of being out as a busybody, as Paul talked about, and tattling and talebearing and all that kind of thing. Gossiping is what he was addressing there. Excuse me. So the wife has the responsibility to run the affairs of the house under the authority of her husband. This would include training and educating and disciplining children. This would include cooking, cleaning, doing laundry, shopping for food and clothes. And this would also include keeping a financial budget, at least for the household expenses. The husband, like I've said before, should be in control of the budget. Now, if he delegates that to the wife, that's fine. But she at least is going to have to manage her own. You give her X amount for groceries or whatever, she's going to have to manage that. Which, just to toot my wife's horn, she's wonderful at. I give her X amount of dollars per month, and she stretches it out and makes it work, makes it last, and I really appreciate that. Now, this is a full-time job and a very important one. And I would say that you can't do this job well and another job, right? Nobody's a super mom, super woman, super whatever. You can't do homemaking well and working another job well. You just can't, right? You don't have enough time to do both of them well. You can eke by and get, you know, you can scrape by and exist, but you can't do it well. This is the highest calling a woman could have. And I fully, completely agree with that. And if it's the highest calling, and if you agree with that, then why would you want to do anything else? That's what I would ask working women. Our modern society has turned the role of women on its head. Our modern society expects women to have full-time careers outside the home. And what happens is this leads to dysfunctional families in which children are raised and trained by strangers in daycares. And that's a big problem. That's causing a lot of problems. Really, think about it. Did we have a better society in the 1950s and before when women, well, women did go to work in the 40s, but then in the 50s, pretty much when the men came home from the war, the women didn't work for a while. The women didn't really start getting into the workforce much, I think, until what, the 70s, I suppose. That's when you had the latchkey kids, that term, right? You left the key under the whatever, and the kids would come home and let themselves in and do who knows what. So anyway, did we have a better society in the 50s and beyond, or in the 70s and after, whenever you had women in the home versus women outside the home? The question obviously answers itself. If a wife is not providing her husband with domestic support, such as cooking, cleaning, doing laundry, grocery shopping, caring for the children, making sure the home is peaceful and warm and welcoming environment, then he's not going to have one of his primary needs for love met. And I think that last part there, peaceful, warm, and welcoming environment, that's really important too. And that is one of the blessings of having a stay-at-home wife, because you can entertain people, right? If you have people come over and your wife is there to take care of them, and she's there all day long, anytime, that's a great thing. And just the other tangential benefits, societal benefits, when you have a stay-at-home wife, then she can be out helping other people in the community if she needs to. She can help the elderly in the community. She can do all kinds of things that she couldn't do if she was out there working. So there are so many benefits to having a wife stay at home. And I could go on and on and on about this. But what happens then? So when she's out working, this leads to stress between the husband and the wife, because the few hours they have together after work are spent trying to keep up with all the cooking and housework that were not done during the day. And this leads to parents not having adequate time to spend with their kids, and then parent-child time gets replaced with TV child time, because there are only so many hours in the day, and you just can't do it all. You've got all this work to do after, all this housework and things to do after work. Put the kid in front of the TV, there's a babysitter, and then try to get everything done before it's time to go to bed. It's not a good idea. And then an unending plethora of after-school activities only exacerbates the problem. So then you take the average family that not only has the working mother, but then they've got kids in sports all year long, going all evening long, every night of the week. It's amazing. I don't know how they do it. I just don't know. Harley says on page 138, studies have shown that especially when children are small, marriages are more successful when women work 20 hours each week or less. Divorce rates double when mothers work full-time outside the home. I did not know that statistic, but it doesn't surprise me in the slightest, because it would be a very stressful life to have if both spouses are working full time. I want to tell you a story here, two little stories. I want to tell you a story of two different households, and you tell me which one sounds better to you, okay? I would say this first one here probably describes most people out there today. And this is not a life that I'd want to live. So here's how it works. Alarm clock goes off, you get up. The husband gets up and he feeds himself, makes his own breakfast, packs his own lunch, while the wife is getting the kids up, getting them ready for school, trying to get them fed, clothed, and ships them off to the school bus while she can, and then she runs off to work, and they both go to work at the same time. And the house is then left in a mess because nobody's got time to clean up because husband and wife are both going and running off to work, right? And then the kids leave school and they spend a couple hours in daycare, or they end up home alone for a few hours on the internet doing, you can guess what they're up to, probably. Then the parents both get home 5:30, 6 o'clock at night. They're both really tired because they both worked full time. And they come home to a mess with no dinner ready. How could dinner be ready? Nobody's been home. And the house is a mess from breakfast because nobody got that cleaned up whenever we both had to rush out of the house and get the kids off to school. And then mom throws something together quickly, warms up a TV dinner, or brings home takeout on the way home from work or something, because after all, when do you have time to go grocery shopping because you're working all day long, right? When do you have time to cook because everybody gets home at the same time and wow, it's practically time to go to bed by the time you get home. Dad and mom spend 1 to 2 hours helping kids with homework on top of all that. Then they rush off to sports games or practice or other activities. The house doesn't get cleaned. The family has little quality time together. They put the kids to bed probably late after all that. Then they try to get the laundry and the dishes and the cleaning and everything else done after all that exhausting day when it's really time to go to bed, and now you're trying to get all this stuff done because there's no other time to do it. And then you get to bed late, exhausted, and wake up a few hours later and do it all again the next day. That sounds like a nightmare to me. That sounds like an absolute nightmare. And I think that's the way most people live in this world today. Now, let me tell you another story. Now, maybe this is a little bit, whenever it's just, amazing utopia. Utopia. Maybe this is a little utopian. Okay, something like that. But I don't think so. I don't think it has to be very utopian. So a husband and wife get up together. Husband spends time in the Word while his wife makes him and the kids a good breakfast. And she makes his lunch for that day too. And then the family all eats breakfast together. And then the husband goes off to work and the wife cleans up after breakfast. And she spends some time with the kids. And then they start their homeschooling if they homeschool, or she gets them on the bus or whatever. And then if they're homeschooling, they finish their homeschooling at 12 or 1 o'clock in the afternoon or so, way before dad ever gets home. They get to go play. They get to go have fun, whatever. The wife does shopping, cleaning, cooking, ironing, laundry during the day. So all that stuff's done, right? It's all done during the day before the husband ever gets home. Wife has a delicious dinner ready when her husband walks in the door. It's not chaos. We're not eating takeout or some garbage like that. It's not crazy. The kids aren't acting up because, you know, they haven't had any attention paid to them all day. Just peaceful, right? Got a nice meal on the table. The family enjoys a nice meal together. Family has quality time afterwards. Maybe they go out for a walk. They read the Bible together. The kids get to bed early. And the husband and wife then have quality time before they get to go to bed because all the housework's done, right? Now, which of those two scenarios would you rather live in? I tell you what, number two, right? Number two for me, I wouldn't want to be anywhere near number one. I wouldn't want anything that even resembles number one. Now, granted, maybe number two is utopian. Maybe it doesn't really work out exactly like that, and it's not just the, you know, Leave It to Beaver or whatever the old shows were that showed the perfect family existence. But I'll tell you what, I'd rather be a lot closer to number two than number one. And it's pretty sad because I think most people live in number one in this culture. And that's really sad. Now, these same problems that are described here can also arise if a wife, even if she's a stay-at-home wife, they can arise if she takes on too many responsibilities for herself or her children and cannot therefore keep up with the cooking and cleaning and laundry and other housework on her own, and therefore expects her husband to pick up the slack. Because I know people too that are or were stay-at-home mothers and did all kinds of other stuff and everything but what she needed to do, right? Wouldn't clean the house, wouldn't do her own work, but she's out there trying to save the world with, you know, helping everybody else out. That's not a good idea either. And then she expects the husband to pick up the slack and to help out. And that's ultimately what happens. In situation number one, no woman can do everything. If you're out there working, you don't have time to do it all. So what do you expect? Your husband to help you out with it. And then his need is not being met anymore. And then that breeds frustration. I'll give you a quote here. Harley talks about that. Page 133 and 134. So deep is a husband's need for domestic support from his wife that he often fantasizes about how she will greet him lovingly and pleasantly at the door, about well-behaved children who likewise act glad to see him and comfort him to the comfort of a well-maintained home. The fantasy continues as his wife urges him to sit down and relax, before taking part in a tasty dinner, its aroma already wafting through the air. You know, with his kids happy to see him. How many parents probably come home and their kids are on those stupid devices, don't even look up to say hi to them because they're busy playing on their dumb phone or iPad or video games or TV? How often does that happen? I'll bet you it happens too often if I had to guess. Conversation at dinner, this is the fantasy here, which could be a reality. Conversation at dinner includes nothing controversial. Later, the family goes out together for an early evening stroll, and he returns to put the children to bed with no hassle or fuss. Then he and his wife relax and talk together, perhaps watch a little television, and go to bed to make love after, or all at a reasonable hour. A lot of wives may chuckle as they read the above scenario, but I assure you it is quite common in the fantasy lives of many husbands. I think that sounds great to me. That sounds like the way it should be to me. Page 135, Harley continues. He said, to put it simply, in most marriages there exists an unspoken trade-off between husband and wife. He expects her to simplify his life by cooking his meals, washing and ironing his clothes, keeping the house picked up, calling a repairman when necessary, and attending to the basic needs of their children. To the extent that she gives him this kind of domestic support, he enjoys his responsibility to provide his family with the income it needs. And that is how it's supposed to work. Everybody has their role. The wife takes care at home, the husband takes care outside the home. He brings home the bacon and she cooks it. When the wife works and the husband has to help with the housework, then trouble arises. I'll give you another quote here from Harley on page 136. This will be the last of this section. So what can be done in a home where both spouses work to make ends meet? In this situation, the wife faces a serious dilemma. She comes home as tired as he does, yet deep down he expects her to cook the meals, wash the dishes, iron the clothes, and entertain the children. He knows better. His logic and reasoning tell him she cannot handle all this and work too. He manfully steps forward to offer help with the housekeeping and care of the children, but nonetheless, he procrastinates. Outbursts of temper and irritation may mar the relationship. All this may evidence the underlying resentment and frustration he feels because one of his basic needs is not being met. I can totally understand that. I would not be a happy camper if I had to come home from work and then help with dishes and laundry and cleaning and all the rest of that stuff. Now we come to the fifth need of men. And this one's short. And this is admiration. Maybe some of you wouldn't have even thought of this as a need for men. When I first read this, it didn't really dawn on me until I read it, and then it really made a lot of sense. This is the final primary need that husbands have, and that is to be admired by their wives. The Bible teaches that wives ought to reverence their husbands, which is a way of saying that they ought to admire them, at least in part. Ephesians 5 and verse 33. It says, nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. To reverence is to salute a person with deep respect, to show respect for one by bowing, kneeling, etc., to make obeisance to, we're not talking about that for husbands and wives, to treat with respect or deference, to esteem, to value highly. So women should esteem and value highly their husbands, and that would be admiration by definition. So the Bible is teaching that women ought to admire their husbands and respect them and esteem them and so on. Men need honest admiration from their wives to thrive. And the key word there is honest. It has to be honest admiration, because feigned admiration doesn't really help any husband. At least if he's got a brain and he can figure out that she's just flattering him, then that doesn't, you're just the best husband in the world. You're the best this or the best that. And if you know yourself, you went out there and changed the oil in the car and you are the best mechanic in the world. You're like, no, I just changed the oil and that's about all I know, or whatever, So it shouldn't be feigned admiration, obviously. Here's what Harley says, page 156 and 157. Honest admiration is a great motivator for most men. When a woman tells a man she thinks he's wonderful, that inspires him to achieve more. He sees himself as capable of handling new responsibilities and perfecting skills far above those of his present level. That inspiration helps him prepare for the responsibilities of life. I wish I could remember this saying. It was something like, if you treat a man like he is, you make him worse. But if you treat a man like he could be, you'll make him into what he should be. Something like that. And there's a lot of truth in that. Same with your kids, right? So if they're not behaving well, if you treat them and act to them in a way that says you're not doing well right now, they're going to do worse. But if you treat them and act toward them in a way that shows them that you could be doing a lot better, then you will inspire them to do better. Is basically what the saying is getting at. Admiration not only motivates, it also rewards the husband's existing achievements. When she tells him that she appreciates him for what he has done, it gives him more satisfaction than he receives from his paycheck. A woman needs to appreciate her husband for what he already is, not for what he could become if he lived up to her standards. And that's very important. You don't want to think, well, I'm going to save my admiration for whenever he's truly admirable. You want to admire him for whatever he's doing good right now, right? If he's doing his best and he's doing something good now, admire him for that and tell him that. Tell him that you really appreciate what he's doing. I mean, if you're going to wait for somebody to be perfect to admire them, you're never going to admire them, right? Here's another quote from Harley, page 157. While criticism causes men to become defensive, admiration energizes and motivates them. A man expects and needs his wife to be his most enthusiastic fan. He draws confidence from her support and can usually achieve far more with her encouragement. You've probably heard the old saying that behind every good man is a good woman or a supportive woman or something to that effect. And I think that's probably true of most situations. It's probably pretty hard for somebody to be a very successful man if he doesn't have a woman that has his back, that is encouraging him, that is supporting him and helping him. It'd be pretty hard. If you had a woman that was nothing but a nag and just constantly down on you, and every time you did something wrong, she was just nagging at you and picking at you and telling you what a screw-up you were, I'd find it really hard to believe that that's going to be a successful man. He may go to work and nobody thinks much of him at work, but if he comes home and his wife thinks much of him, that motivates him to keep pressing on. So I'd say, wives, you never want to put down your husband. You never want to make him feel stupid or inferior, especially in front of others. Never do it, period, but never in front of others. Never make fun of your husband in the company of others. Now, if it's just poking fun and teasing, you know, I think you understand the difference, right? But you'd never want to make some cutting remark in front of somebody else about your husband. Nor would husbands want to do that about their wives. But that could really hurt a husband, big time. And if your wife starts comparing you to other men or saying, I wish you were like that other guy or something like that, especially in front of other people, that's really going to hurt a husband. Behind every man should be an admiring wife, Harley said. He says on page 158, biographies of great men prove it, and lives of all men show it. A man simply thrives on a woman's admiration. To a great extent, men owe gratitude to their wives for this kind of emotional support. For without it, their confidence, the major source of their success, erodes and eventually crumbles. I remember hearing a talk, I think it was by a guy that might have been a congressman himself, and he was also some kind of a motivational speaker. And he was saying that he remembers seeing a bunch of presidential candidates' wives being interviewed on a show one time. And I think what they were trying to do is show the American people that their husbands were just men like everybody else. They were people like everybody else. But they were kind of poking fun at them and not respecting them really and saying, well, you ought to see what he looks like when he gets up in the morning or this or that, like that kind of thing. And just like one of these probably stupid The View shows or something like that. And that's horrible to do to a man. That does not make a man feel good, and it would not make me think, oh, well, he's just a guy like me. I want to vote for him or whatever. I think that would have backfired. Now, the key to it, as I said earlier, is praise and admiration from a wife must be sincere. Harley says, never fake your admiration. By simply saying flattering words to your husband, you can do more harm than good. To have any value, praise must genuinely reflect your feelings. See, a wise husband, he's going to consider the praise that he receives from his wife. And he's going to examine it to see if it's true. Look at Proverbs 27:21. This is what I do. I think my wife genuinely praises me, and sometimes I don't even believe it because I don't believe what she even says about me. I don't have that opinion of myself, and I wonder, is she just telling me that? Because I don't even, you know, I don't see it that way sometimes. Proverbs 27 and verse 21. As the fining pot for silver and the furnace for gold, so is a man to his praise. See, the fining pot refines the silver. It gets rid of the dross and only keeps the good stuff. Same with the furnace for gold. So does a man to his praise. A man refines his praise. When somebody praises him, he takes that praise and he scrapes away all of the flattery and all of the falsehood out of it, and he only keeps what's true. A wise man, a fool, just says, oh, great, wonderful. I am really an awesome guy. I always figured that, right? A wife must learn to express true admiration for her husband, and her husband must give her reasons for doing so. So this is also on the husbands, too. If you want to be admired, well, then be admirable. Right? If you're just a bum or whatever, and you go out there and drink the paycheck away every month or something like that, well, you know, there's probably not a whole lot to admire there. But here's a quote. This is the last quote from Harley. You need a plan to help you express true feelings of admiration. That means no word games, nothing phony, only true, honest feelings. You've seen how the love bank works, and if you read the book, you'd know what he's talking about. You've seen how the love bank works, how learning to meet each other's marital needs creates the feeling of love. Well, the process of creating the feeling of respect in a woman works in a very similar way. As a man learns to meet his wife's five most important needs, she finds herself responding with a natural and overflowing respect for him. Conversely, if a man does not meet these needs, she cannot, in all honesty, express the admiration he needs from her. Therefore, her admiration depends on his ability to meet her basic marital needs. Remember what I said early where I said I was harder on the men because if there's a problem, it's probably the man's fault. And if the woman's got a problem, it's probably your husband's fault. If you're not getting admiration that you need, it could be that your wife is just an ingrate, right? Or it could be that maybe you're not meeting her needs. You're not making her respect and admire you because you're just selfish and out for yourself. That could be. So if you need more admiration, ask yourself, am I admirable? And if I am admirable, then see what's going on here because you're probably not meeting your wife's needs or she would be lavishing praise upon you. So anyway, that takes care of his needs, her needs. So just to recap, let me see, can I remember them all? Her needs, affection, communication, honesty and openness, financial support, what's number five? I can't remember. I can't hear it. She's trying to mouth it to me. She can't talk in church. It'll come to me. And then men's needs were sexual fulfillment, recreational companionship. See, I'm cheating here now. Attractive wife, domestic support, and admiration. Family support, family commitment. I can finally read lips. Okay. Family commitment. There you go. That's her five needs. So now I'm going to be quizzing you. You better get all 10 of them now. All right. Anyway, so that takes care of this series. I hope it was a blessing for you. I hope that that we all take this to heart and consider it and think about it. Listen to it again. Right. I listen to I don't listen to all of them, but I've listened to this sermon. I've listened to these sermons again. Because these are things that we all need to really consider and to make sure that we put time and effort into making our marriages good. Anyway, thank you for listening.